Who is speaking?
This is Kim Aliyah.
Oh, Kim. I'm Krishna.
Hi, Krishna. How are you?
I'm fine.
Good.
That 20th one was very, very good. I really enjoyed it.
Which one was that?
The Arjun Netricum and Arjun.
Oh, good. I'm glad you... Yeah, that was a very good call. I agree.
Very, very good.
Good. Glad you liked it.
So, how are you?
Yeah, I'm doing pretty well. And yourself?
I'm doing all right.
Yeah? Well, good. Who else is on the call?
Trudy.
Hey, Trudy. How's it going?
Oh, fine.
Good.
I'm looking forward to the lecture.
Oh, good.
Kim, can I ask you just for one second something?
Yeah.
That arsen iodide and arsen help. Is that arsen iodide is to be warm, isn't it?
That's
because
correct.
Iodide.
Not only is it warmer than arsenic amalgam, but it's also quite a bit more restless because the iodum element in arsenicum iodatum not only adds the heat, but it also adds an extra element of energy to the remedy. And so you'll see them as being very, very warm, very restless, oftentimes with thyroid problems, specifically hyperthyroidism. So, you'll see something along those lines.
Well, the cancer part, I'm saying, cancer lung, secondaries. Mm-hmm. She's a friend of mine, and she rang me, and I just have come up arsen help. But arsen iodide is coming very strongly, so I was thinking, what is the difference between arsen help and arsen
iodide?
Well,
remember, arsenicum album is going to be a very chilly remedy, and arsenicum iodatum is going to be a very warm remedy. So that by itself should make an easy
demarcation. And for cancerous lesions, which are advanced ones, which are secondaries, and she's having radiotherapy and a chemotherapy, so that means iodide part is important there, is it?
Well, it's certainly a remedy for cancer. There's no question about it.
Oh, remedy for cancer.
Yeah. Okay. Anybody else on the call who'd like to say hello?
Hello.
Oh, hi. It's Rudy.
Hello. Stephen and Rudy?
Well, I don't know about Stephen. It's Rudy.
Well,
hey, Rudy.
I don't know about Rudy, but it's Stephen.
Okay.
Can you
guys come to some type of agreement about the situation?
What's that?
I'm just joking around.
And we appreciate it.
Okay. So why don't we go ahead and get started? We're a few minutes after 5 o'clock, so let me go ahead and mute out everybody. We're going to use the same format that we always do on these calls. I'm going to do a formal interview for the first perhaps 40, 45 minutes, and then I'll unmute the phone and allow people on the call to ask any questions that they've been dying to ask Rudy and Stephen. So hold on, let me go ahead and mute everybody else. Stephen and Rudy, can you still hear me?
Yep, hear you fine.
Just fine.
Good. Well, let me first of all introduce the both of you. This is the third in a three-part series of calls. The first two were excellent. We got very good feedback on both of them. Unfortunately, the second call, which was recorded, was lost by the teleconferencing company, and so unfortunately we will not be able to post that on our website, so perhaps we can do a future call that kind of covers the same basic information that we covered on the second call, which unfortunately got lost somewhere in the recording process. Let me go ahead and introduce both Rudy and Stephen. I know Rudy personally. I consider him a good friend of mine. He's the head of the Heilkunst, Hahnemann Heilkunst School in Ottawa. He's been studying homeopathy now and practicing for, I believe, Rudy, how many years is it?
Well, getting close to 20.
Close to 20 years, okay. He's the author of Homeopathy Renewed, A Sequential Approach to the Treatment of Chronic Illness, plus A Time for Healing, Homeopathy Reexamined Beyond the Classical Paradigm, and I think his most recent work is called The Dynamic Legacy, Hahnemann from Homeopathy to Heilkunst, which I believe is up on their website, but I'll let Stephen clarify that further. He also helped to found and still active in the National United Professional Association of Trained Homeopaths, otherwise known as NUPATH, and also the Canadian International Heilkunst Association. Rudy is a very deep thinker in homeopathy, has a lot of valuable information to share, and certainly in my own case has helped me to dispel a lot of the myths that surround what we call quote-unquote classical homeopathy. Stephen Decker, who's the permanent holder of the Gotian Chair of Philosophy at the Hahnemann College for Heilkunst, is a student for the last 25 years of various people's works, including Johann Wolfgang von Goethe, Samuel Taylor Coleridge, Rudolf Steiner, and Wilhelm Reich. He's also the translator of the sixth edition of the Organon, which was then further was annotated by Wender Brewster O'Reilly, and many people consider that to be the most precise of the English translations of the sixth edition of the Organon. Stephen Decker is a brilliant man in his own right. If you ever speak to Rudy Vesper or his lovely wife, Patty Smith, they will basically tell you that he's one of the few real geniuses that we have in homeopathy. So let me, again, thank you both for taking the time out of your busy schedules to join us. And do you have anything you'd like to add to my introduction in terms of, I know you were offering some free materials in the past. Is there anything that you'd like to let anybody know about right now?
Well, I would just clarify one thing, that the translation of the Organon and chronic diseases, plus some additional works from the so-called lesser writings that Stephen translated and which was used as a basis for Wender Brewster O'Reilly's edition, Stephen now has his full translation, interlinear version, German interlinear, and an English rendition available to be downloaded as an electronic book on Amazon.com. And this is an amazing research tool. This allows you to search on words and concepts which would take you days, months, years to do otherwise if you're doing it individually. So this is a massive work that Stephen has undertaken, and will provide a lot of scope for further research. It certainly has helped us in our work. As well, certainly the Dynamic Legacy, as you mentioned, which is the main work that we have used coming out of Stephen's translation to help us better understand Hahnemann's works, that is available electronically, not in printed version, but electronically. And we have made a free access available to any listener of these conferences or subscriber to Whole Health Now if they want, just to let us know, and we'll give them a password. I think it's available until the end of August or early September. We also have three books available for download that cover a lot of the topics that we've talked about in this teleconference on the www.heilkunst.com website. So, did I just add that part?
And the Dynamic Legacy electronic format can also be found at www.heilkunst.com.
You can get you can find information about it, but you can't download it or access it from there. You have to get a code, and then we'll tell you where to go.
Okay, but if they go to the Heilkunst website,
they'll find out all the information.
And just so, can you spell it for everybody, just so they know how it's spelled? So
okay, Heilkunst, the German term, HEILKUNST.
Great. Okay, well, that's excellent. I'm sure everyone's going to really appreciate getting all of that information. Okay, so let's go ahead and get started. I think I'll pick up kind of where we left off on the last call. You know, during the last two sessions, you mentioned several times the work of Rudolf Steiner and anthroposophical medicine. You also mentioned Wilhelm Reich's name a few times, and orgonomy. And, you know, for I think the people on this call, I'm sure they've never, you know, in their readings of Hahnemann's writings, they've never heard, you know, Hahnemann refer to Steiner or refer to Wilhelm Reich. So I thought perhaps you could clarify for people, you know, what role these individuals' people's work has in relationship to the teaching of Hahnemann's Heilkunst, and how are they part of the dynamic system that you're that you've been discussing over the last two calls?
Stephen, you want to start on that one?
I guess I could start on that one. So many things occur to me when you ask a question like that that it's hard to narrow it down. Anthroposophic medicine was a tremendous expansion on many of the things that Hahnemann laid down in the Organon. And organomic medicine was yet a further expansion of things that Hahnemann laid down in the Organon. And it's been my endeavor over the last several years to try and effect a merger between anthroposophy and organomy, the likes of which I've never seen done before, and then to tie all of that back to Heilkunst, which it works with beautifully. So as far as the role that you ask about, it fulfills many functions, and one of them is that it gives us a general orientation, because there are certain goals to both therapies that give us a map, that furnish a map of where we're going and where we're at any given time between the two poles of perfect health on the one side and death on the other. So without that map, it would be difficult to know, if you were eliminating symptoms along the way, just exactly where you were on in the terrain, in the bioterrain, with reference to those, without reference to goals. And this goal referencing is what gives us a directional progression. It gives us more than just a two-dimensional map, but I mentioned bioterrain, but almost like a topographical map, which allows us, as you know, in looking at a topographical map, you can see the relative heights and the elevations that you have to traverse in going from one point to another, and it's not just a straight line as the crow flies. So you get to see this in anthroposophic medicine in terms of the expansion on the members, or what Hahnemann told us in the Organon was the makeup, the general makeup of man, which for him was not simply a matter of some material organism, although it certainly included that, but that it was it included both the soul and the spirit of man. And when Rudolf Steiner came along with his heightened powers of cognition, he was able to expand upon that to a large degree and gave us a threefold spiritual man, a threefold soul man, and a threefold bodily dimension, which included not only the physical body, but the etheric and the astral body as well. So in order to tie all of that into Hahnemann, it was a matter of sort of correlating what Steiner was talking about with such terms as the vital force, as it has been commonly translated in Hahnemann, as the etheric body. That would be your etheric body. He sometimes called it the life, which is our word in English, life. And then the feeling, the principle or the feeling nature of man, which Steiner called the astral body, is something that you find in Hahnemann in various ways also. So All of these matters that were in Hahnemann as far as his general makeup of man were further expanded upon by Steiner in such a way that we began to be able to organize the relationships between these members in a way that was not possible before. You could go beyond symptoms, in other words, in order to find out what was going on between these members in terms of functional fluctuations, et cetera, et cetera. So on the other hand, we had ergonomy, which was sort of working from the other pole more than Steiner. It was working, I would say, primarily from what Hahnemann gives in aphorisms 9 and 10 as the sort of upper man, who is the rational spirit in aphorism 9. But in aphorism 10, he's talking about the dynamis and giving it its own agenda. And of course, Hahnemann was always trying to get a conversation going between what he called the intelligent physician and this biodynamic entity that was able to express itself in symptoms. So these two beings were something that Steiner brought to full force in his writings, and as did Reich. And so the orientation to health is something that was very important as far as these two beings, because to the extent that they're related, they're relating harmoniously, you will have an approach to health. And when they have an ego wedge driven in between them, you will have various disturbances which constitute the field of needing therapy. So there's a lot more that can be said about anthroposophy and ergonomy. It's huge topics, but I'll let Rudy kind of complete whatever has occurred to him while listening.
Well, I think this is really Stephen's genius that has been able to ferret out the, you could say, the illumination that comes from reading Steiner and Reich. For me, it's a bit like getting a zip file and unzipping it, but you can't unzip Hahnemann without having these other programs. And anthroposophical medicine and ergonomic medicine basically provide a tremendous illumination and unfoldment of the genius of Hahnemann. Hahnemann's statements are so dense in some cases that, you know, they pack a tremendous amount of knowledge in there, but if you don't have the right program to unlock it, it doesn't mean too much, as witness the fact that most people read right over a lot of that stuff. But Stephen has been able to find the key to unfold a lot of this, and it just folds in very harmoniously and allows you to understand, certainly aphorism 9 and 10, come to brilliant light in the works of both Steiner and Reich. So from a therapeutic perspective, you have a much greater understanding of what's happening to the patient. And as Stephen points out, you also have an orientation and a goal that you're aiming at. So this is really a fulfillment in the 20th century of, you know, the germ or seed that Hahnemann laid very much back 200 years ago.
Now, I know that in anthroposophical medicine, they have their own very specific system of therapeutics that utilizes potentized remedies.
Yes.
Do you utilize anything from specifically from that practical implementation of?
We have started with the you could say the theoretical framework of anthroposophical medicine, and we have started looking at the integration of various aspects, particularly the so-called dorons that Rudolf Steiner left prescriptions for. Much of anthroposophical medicine, in my view and experience, is really focusing on what we would call regimen or the law of opposites. It's not really using, even though it may use quote-unquote homeopathic or potentized remedies, they're really being used on the basis of a different prescription, which is the law of opposites, not the law of similars. So it may look similar, but it's not actually. We have found that much of the other stuff they've added in after Steiner hasn't been as useful, but that the so-called dorons are very, very have the great potential to help strengthen and balance the organism. But Hahnemann actually had a much more powerful therapeutic system when it came to the law of similars and medicine proper. But anthroposophy provides a very powerful model for helping us understand, not just, as Stephen pointed out, the overall structure, but also in the context of balance, and which is what Hahnemann would call regimen or obstacles to cure and the use of the law of opposites.
Yes, I would add to that that it was confusing at first when I read Steiner, when he was talking about what Kim was just referring to, these potentized substances, because
yeah.
It seems from the outset it must be the same thing. But I had to get to a point where I saw through that, and I could see that it was really Steiner who brought something totally new to the table. And that was that instead of applying the law of similars to diseases, he was applying the law of opposites to imbalances. And these imbalances I referred to just a moment ago as far as the imbalance of activities between, say, the etheric body, the physical body, and the astral body and the mental organization. But that in this case, instead of just having kind of an abstract point or an abstract concept of a balance along a line, Steiner was able to reach out with his heightened cognition into nature and find that there were various plant substances and animal substances, et cetera, and mineral substances that actually supplied a model for the substantive power, as we've called it in former teleconferences, that gave it a model of balance, so that if there was an imbalance along a certain axis or along a certain polarity, and those polarities abound in anthroposophic medicine, they are termed and named very specifically, then what Steiner endeavored to do was to place a model inside the patient that gave the kind of innate wisdom of the body's own wisdom something to cite off of in writing that balance. And so if there was something connected, for example, with the kidney function being out of order and a polarity connected with that, he would supply equisetum. And equisetum would supply a model around which the patient's own internal dynamic could range itself and then supply its own equilibrium after time by imitating the model. So it's not to be seen as something that is rivaling Hahnemann in any way. It was a kind of polaric opposite to what Hahnemann was doing. And as I said, it took me a long time to be able to see through what seemed to be the obvious correlation, because they were using potentized substances, but it turned out that they were using them in a quite different way, and that was using the law of opposites and not the law of similars. So it was a method of remediation that did not suppress, but simply balanced. And that was something that Hahnemann opened the door to at the end of the Organon.
Would that be like an internal biodynamic farming, like
yeah,
dealing with the terrain?
You could call it a kind of internalized biodynamic farming after a term that was coined right after Steiner but had to do with farming practices. So, yes, it was an internal milieu that was being farmed.
Very interesting, gentlemen. I mean, I think that's one of the clearest explanations I've ever heard for
the differences between the anthroposophical approach and the homeopathic approach. So thank you very much for that answer. I'm curious, are there any other adjuncts to Heilkunst that you would want to mention along with what we've been talking about already?
Well, I could say that just about any therapeutic modality that has any efficacy at all in a dynamic way is a potential adjunct to the Heilkunst system. It is the least exclusionary of all systems of curing and healing. And when I look through a book like, for example, Alternative Medicine, and I see two columns of various alternative therapies, any one or two or three or any number of them could be utilized in this overall orientation plan that I spoke of before as far as aiding and abetting the reaching of the goal of therapy. So medicine is one aspect of therapeutics, and regimen can have myriad aspects, and somebody needs to stand on their head once in a while, maybe to get blood flow stimulated to the head or to the brain, and a very simple idea, but there's so many different therapeutic models out there that you would get lost in the sea of the narrow apertures that are being applied to utilizing them. And what we would like to do is to be able to see them all in a symphonic orchestra, all seated together and playing in harmony and actually trying to achieve the goal of therapy, which is what anthroposophic and ergonomic medicine allow us to see, is this great, big, huge picture. And they basically can use any therapeutic modality.
I like to liken it to, in modern-day computer terms, that Hahnemann gave us, in a sense, a motherboard. And we have to plug in all the various chips and other aspects that go on there, and each in its own place. What you have in naturopathic medicine, for example, is just a kind of a potpourri and a smattering, a little bit of this, a little bit of that, but not necessarily any commanding presence, as Stephen would point out, a conductor to come in and make it all harmonize and make music. And you just get a cacophonous effect sometimes, or you're only using some of the instruments. So with Heilkunst, the key really is to find each therapy and find what it does really well and different from any other, and then plug it into the system and say, okay, well, I want to use this therapy to achieve this effect under this principle, rather than, well, let's just try this and see what happens. And that's really the goal of Heilkunst, ultimately, in my view.
Absolutely. So we're utilizing something that we've had to make a distinction of, and that when we were talking about anthroposophic remedies, we would include them under the title of the older term physic, and leave medicine to Hahnemann, because he was the one who definitively was able to bring all the various definitions to bear that made medicine what it was, because it related to the generative power and utilized the law of similars. So this is something that is quite different, is this caduceus, that gives new meaning to the caduceus, and that is this simultaneous use of physic, quote-unquote, on the one hand, and this medic approach, which is what Hahnemann designed primarily, although he referenced himself continually to the regimen side, saying that that's where all the obstacles to cure lay, and that they needed to be systematically removed through correct lifestyle or moving out of a damp cellar in a marshy region or a bad marriage. All these things are mentioned in his writings, but of course nowadays it refers to the pollution, the general pollution of our air and food and water and vaccinations, et cetera, and all of these things have to be addressed in some way, which would provide an obstacle to cure for medicine. And so we have to systematically go about kind of taking off the pickup sticks in the right order.
You know, maybe we can get down to some specifics, specifically with regard to the Heilkunst approach. Could you tell me what methods you use to take and treat cases, and how does that differ from, you know, what's normally called, you know, quote-unquote classical homeopathy? And maybe you could, because, you know, people, if you don't define that term, they're not going to know why I'm saying quote-unquote. So could you maybe kind of differentiate Heilkunst from what's called classical homeopathy, and then specifically tell us, you know, what methods you specifically use to take and treat cases and what the differences are?
Okay, well, I can start on that one. Basically, first of all, it's important to understand that homeopathy or homeopathic medicine is a part of Heilkunst, of Hahnemann's system. when we refer to the term classical homeopathy, what we refer to is the fact that somehow the concentration or focus, monofocus on using the law of similars against the symptoms of a disease or that the patient exhibited, this led people to be blind to all the other aspects of Hahnemann's system, and it also led them to a kind of uniformitarianism, where they basically just take all the symptoms of the patient and somehow assume that that can be put into some disease picture without any real understanding of exactly what disease is, and without any understanding, as we pointed out in the other two teleconferences, that even Hahnemann stated that a patient could have more than two or three diseases at a time. And therefore, it begs the question, well, if you take the symptoms of the patient, how do you know which symptoms belong to which disease? So the fundamental difference, I'd say, right from the very get-go between Heilkunst and so-called classical homeopathy is that Heilkunst doesn't presume that all the patients simply belong to a disease. It recognizes, as Hahnemann did, that there's all these lifestyle issues, dietary issues, fundamental issues like nutrition, hydration, sleep, pollution, shocks and traumas, that all are generating disturbances at all levels of the members, physical, etheric, astral, ontic, or ego structure. And each one of them may be producing symptoms, may not be producing symptoms. You can be sick and have no symptoms, or have symptoms and be healthy. So instead of trying to assume that all the symptoms can be fixed by finding a remedy on the medicine side, it looks at the patient and says, well, what's the patient doing with respect to sleep? If it's not getting enough sleep, some of these symptoms may simply be a result of lack of sleep. So go and get some better sleep, and then maybe 20% of the symptoms disappear. I had a patient who had arthritic symptoms simply because he didn't hydrate properly. It was not a matter of a disease. It was just he wasn't drinking enough. So that's the fundamental difference. So when we get a patient, we start looking at all these different areas and assessing. We ask them questions on regimen, on lifestyle. We look at their nutrition against the diet typologies that have been developed, you know, according to their blood type or their glandular type. We try to ascertain where is the disturbance coming from. And it may not just be from one area. It can be from a number of different areas. But then you face the question, well, what's the approach or sequence? What do we start with first? So within Heilkunst, we have a protocol that exists, which, as Hahnemann pointed out, you have to approach the patient sequentially. So there's a kind of sequence of treatment that goes from, well, are you drinking enough, all the way up to, do you have a core belief that is blocking your ability to be healthy? So Stephen, you have anything to add to that? Or?
I could only expand upon that by saying, yes, these symptoms that gather in a pool because of dehydration or subclinical dehydration, we could call it, or symptoms of undernourishment or malnutrition, bad nutrition, which abound in our societies today, along with the lack of sleep that you mentioned, which is not only quantitatively but now qualitatively to be ascertained because of certain recent developments, such as Lights Out by T.S. Wiley. All of these things, and underexertion, people being couch potatoes, it used to be that in older times we actually had to get up and move around to get our jobs done, and now we could practically sit in front of a computer all day long and not twitch a muscle other than a finger. And so we actually need to qualify the patient for higher therapeutic applications by going through their what we call their cardinal points, those four points we just mentioned, and getting them to commit to taking responsibility for themselves. And we've seen hosts of symptoms disappear simply because they took responsibility for their sleep and their food and their water and their exercise, and what was left over is what Hahnemann would call a pure image that you could work with when it came to the application of medicine. But without that pure image, you've got this welter of symptoms that really don't have anything to do with the disease, but simply with imbalances caused by lifestyle. So that is there is a protocol, as Rudy said, that we have worked out over time, which is very much in accordance with what Hahnemann laid down, and it's just a matter of systematically going through these various stages and dimensions and clearing all of the various problems that can occur because of lifestyle choices. And even so, on the medical side, which we talked about before, that was a matter of starting down in the realm of toxins and moving up through iatrogenic insults and things that weren't possible so much during Hahnemann's time but have been made possible recently, and then moving into the miasms and the traumatic timeline above that and on into the ideogenic belief system above that, as well as taking into consideration pathic symptom images that come up along the way that need to be treated at the same time. So there's a very complex, and yet it's also simple to see, if you have this map, what dimensions you have to go through in order to clear the patient systematically, instead of just sort of aiming at various problems and taking pot shots at it and hoping that everything else will go away too. So it's amazing what we were able to go back once we got away from the transmogrification caricature that was made of Hahnemann and got back to Hahnemann himself, what we were able to find there. And people hadn't even caught up with it at this point in history.
Yeah, and I think it's important to point out that if you go back and read Hahnemann, and I certainly recommend getting Stephen's translation, but it's amazing how much he talked about regimen and diet, and he gave people dietary advice. He told them to read the Organon, as a kind of mental exercise and to live better. He talks about all these obstacles to cure, and there's no point in giving a remedy if you're not eating right or living right. And all of that he considered very important. And what we've done is just sort of elaborated, expanded on that. But the essence of it is already in Hahnemann himself.
And that's why we laid all of this information meticulously down in Dynamic Legacy, which your hearers have access to.
Now, aside from the regimen differences, the focus on, regimen in the Hawkins approach, what about in terms of the remedies themselves? I know that in what people consider to be classical homeopathy, there's this idea that you only give one remedy at a time, and I know we've touched upon this in the past, but I think it's important in terms of talking about the differences between classical homeopathy and Hawkins to address this particular issue.
Okay. Well, I mean, the fundamental point here is, as we discussed in the previous teleconference, unfortunately the tape was lost, but I think we touched on it as well in the first one, is the issue that what Hahnemann in essence was saying is one remedy per disease. Now, at the level of what we call the pathic disease, which is the disease, the secondary ones that are treated by homeopathic medicine, you can only really do one at a time. But at the level of the constant nature diseases, or what we call tonic diseases that Hahnemann identified, such as a chronic miasm or ailment from suppressed grief or a particular vaccination shock, these things can exist in more than one within a given time frame. And you can treat them according to cause, not according necessarily to the overt symptomology. So that, for example, if you have a surgical procedure, a patient going through a surgical procedure, you would have potentially in that kind of time frame of surgery, you would have a contusion disease, you would have a shock caused by the hypodermic needle, by the drugs used, by the invasion of the body's sanctity. And if you put all of that together, you would get what Dr. Ajidi would call an informed disease, in a sense. And that would be addressed by various remedies, each one addressing each one of those diseases. So you may give five remedies, for example, for that particular incident, because it represents a series of causes happening more or less at the same time, which Stephen would call the concordant disease, and you need a concordant remedy for that. So sometimes we give one remedy for one disease because that's all that exists at that time. But other times you need to give more than one remedy, And that is a fundamental difference. But again, that is based in Hahnemann, who himself pointed out that we can have more than one disease at a time. And also that there are specific remedies for these tonic or constant basin or nature diseases. So it's not a matter of having to look at the symptoms and trying to determine which remedy. The moment you know the cause, you can pretty well identify the remedy. So, for example, if someone had a tetanus vaccination and received, got sick after that, the remedy would be very obvious. It would be the, you could say, the Izode or the Nozode, depending on how you made it, for the tetanus vaccination. This is how we treat very effectively for conditions like autism, for example, where much of the disturbance has been triggered by multiple vaccinations, children getting up to 30 vaccinations by the time they're 2 or 3 years old. And these things shock the system. So if someone gets an MMR vaccination, they need a remedy called MMR, which is just potentized vaccine material carried up to a high potency in order to remove that shock. So this is not based on the symptomology. It's not based on approving of MMR to determine whether you give it. And it's the same with the chronic miasms. Dr. Almaguer pointed out very clearly, but he drew this from Hahnemann himself, and we point that out in the dynamic legacy, that if you have multiple miasmatic diseases, then there is a sequence to treatment. And he calls that the law of succession of forces. And Hahnemann himself, in a sense, gives the incipient nature of that law, but Dr. Almaguer just brought it out a little bit more clearly. And there, it's not a matter, again, of the symptomology. You give sorinum for sora and tuberculinum for tuberculosis and metorhinum for psychosis and syphilinum for syphilis. And there's a certain sequence and order for that, which pretty well applies in our experience to every patient. So those are some of the fundamental differences, I think.
I might add, too, that this approach has lived over time under various guises, somewhat veiled, but we heard a lot within the last several years of something called essence prescribing, which openly avows that it has to go behind or beyond the symptoms in order to be able to arrive at the correct remedy. Unfortunately, there was a kind of a mystical obscurity over the whole thing, and it was left to some kind of intuition which couldn't be explained too well. When Rajan Sankaran came along, he lifted it out of that obscurity, and he gave us kind of like the top dimension as far as this essence prescribing was concerned, but in a way that was intelligible and rational. Rudy just mentioned Dr. Almaguer at one level, and down beneath that, we've had in more recent times this onslaught of toxicity that has been surrounding us, and due to the offices of Dr. Reykjavik and Dr. Schimmel, we have gotten to a point where we're able to negotiate that realm. And I might add also that the further away from health you go, the more fragmented the system is, just like your disk when you use it on a computer. It gets more and more fragmented as you use it, and you have to defragment it. And the same thing is true in the healthcare field. So the further down you've gone in your overall health index, the more fragmented you become and the more isolated causes that you can pinpoint that are causing disturbances, and that's why there can be several operating at the same time. The higher up you go, the more unified it all becomes, and by the time you get to the etiogenic realm, you would be giving only one single remedy at that level. So it's just a matter of where you are in the map and how much disk fragmentation you have, which determines the level of causality that you have to deal with, as Rudy just said. And so the methodology is going to be dependent upon this realistic appraisal of what you're dealing with in the patient in the year 2004. It's quite different than it was 200 years ago.
Well, very interesting and very stimulating discussion. Perhaps, you know, and this is very interesting, and it really creates a lot of food for thought, but you know, perhaps as a final question, because you were talking about in very kind of theoretical terms here, and philosophy is wonderful and principles are great, but when it really comes down to it, the bottom line is the results. So I'm really curious to if you guys could share with me what type of results you're getting using the Heilkunst Complete Medical System of Hahnemann.
Well, I guess, you know, the issue of success is always a difficult one to measure, depending on how you define success. But I would say in our experience, when we look at it, the success rate is up in the 90-95% level, even with very difficult and complicated cases. That doesn't mean that you get there right away or you get there with one remedy or in 3 months. But we have cases that have been tried by many, many other methods and other systems, and it's still difficult for us. But as Stephen pointed out, we're able to negotiate it because we have a broader perspective. We're able to address more things, but not just more things. We're able to address them at the right time with the right remedy. It's not enough just to have the right remedy. It's also important to give the right remedy at the right time. And that remedy can include on the regimental side, you know, enough water, enough exercise and sleep, or detoxification, or on the medic side or the medicine side, it can include the right pathic remedy or tonic remedy, even the right, Hahnemann would prescribe the Organon to his patients. It might even require a certain amount of therapeutic education in the sense of pointing out to the patient certain things that they're doing that are really an illusion and contributing to their disease state. But we basically, if people stick with the process and the program, we have very few cases that I can really recall that we did not achieve success. There have been difficulties. It takes time. But I'm amazed even our graduates right from the very beginning can achieve that level of success. So this is not something you get just because you've been practicing for 15, 20 years. This is something because it's scientific and based on principle and ultimately, as Stephen pointed out, becomes very simple once you understand it, even though it's complex in nature. Even a recent graduate can get those kinds of results.
Yes, and I can only add that my own experience when I came to classical homeopathy many years ago was one of great frustration because on the one hand, I was able to read the literature, which was very inspiring, and copious cases of cures being presented. And on the other hand, when I ventured out to some very well-known homeopaths myself, and then later on when I saw friends and relatives and family members do the same, I never found any real satisfaction, that nothing curative ever really happened. There were a couple of shifts once in a while that I would experience, but nothing that was fundamentally curative. There were effects that were happening, but not real cures of any sort that I could actually describe to you. So we heard a lot about subtle changes and you have to wait a long time and whatever, but nothing of a fundamental radical nature ever took place with all of my experience in embracing all of the people that I knew. And so I just got to a point where I was literally pitchforked into going beyond the classical model and trying to look behind the veil to see what might be the problem and what the answer might be, which is what has led to all that we've been discussing over the last three teleconferences. So it was just a simple empirical matter with me. I could tell you some good stories. One very, very well-known figure in homeopathy told me the same thing on the phone, is that he'd never had any success with it, but it made sense to him. It was just such a wonderful idea. And the same was true of my collaborator, Wenda Brewster O'Reilly. She went to some of the best homeopaths, and she never had any success either, as far as she could report. And so it was this plus a lot of other reports that started coming in when I went to conferences that led me to suspect that there was something radically wrong here and that it needed to be overcome, or there was nothing to what Hahnemann left behind. Well, fortunately there was, but not the classical version.
Yeah, I think I remember reading somewhere that Sankaran himself said that, you know, the success rate was somewhere in the nature of 10-15%. And I remember, Kim, when we first met, I think it was at a Vatulkas conference here in Toronto, in Canada. And I remember talking to George Vatulkas privately and asking him, you know, how successful he was. And he admitted privately that only in 30% of cases did he really know which remedy he might want to give. And of those, maybe half at the most were successful. Well, that's not a high success rate. You get better rate if you get placebo. So I think with the Heilkens model, using all of the tools and insights that Hahnemann left for us, But by developing in them further than he was able to, we've been able to offer patients a much greater chance of success than simply using one of those tools, and then using it in a way which really is a rather one-sided.
Well, yes, especially when you consider the 15 myths that we talked about in a former conference.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, gentlemen, thank you very much. I'm going to I have many more questions I could ask, but I'm going to hold myself back and open up the call to the general audience, and I'm sure that people have been thinking about some of the very interesting things that we've been talking about and we'll have some very interesting questions. So hold on 1 second, and I'll unmute everybody. Okay.
Hello?
Are people there?
We're here.
We're here.
Hello.
So, anybody have any questions?
I have got a question. That means that acute prescribing, chronic prescribing, so the difference is in acute prescribing, this thing is actually, in chronic prescribing it is becomes important. But in acute prescribing, like, you have to give, like, instant treatment. So then you get more success. But in chronic prescribing, this is the, which is very important, that you have to go back to these tools.
And the question was, I'm not sure.
Acute prescribing and chronic prescribing.
The difference between them, is that your question?
Yeah.
Okay, did you want to go ahead and field that one?
Well, I'm not sure if it's a question. It's quite clear that in an acute situation, Hahnemann pointed out, you deal with it immediately. And it's quite true. Much of what we would call first aid is actually not prescribed on the basis of symptoms. It's prescribed on the basis of cause. You get bitten by a bee, or you get hit by a hammer, or, you know, you fall down and get a sprain or a strain. All of these things are prescribed very quickly and very simply by what we would term tonic remedies, arnica, apis, ruda, etc. These are all remedies that correspond on a what Hahnemann called a homogenic basis to the particular acute trauma.
Irritation.
Sorry?
Yeah, the irritant.
Yeah, the irritant, the disease irritation. And so that's very easily done, very quickly done, certainly. But even up at the chronic level, that kind of prescribing is very easily done. The wonderful thing about tonic prescribing, even in a chronic situation, is once you know the cause, you already have the remedy. You don't have to sit and search for it. It's like a tube for the price of one. If I know that the cause is an MMR vaccination, I just give them that remedy, and I don't have to go and search for the symptoms or find a pathic remedy using a computer repertory. So it becomes very simple even at the acute and the chronic level. What is complex at the chronic level and difficult is that there are many causes causing a given chronic condition. So if you take a condition like fibromyalgia, there's no remedy for fibromyalgia. It's not a disease. It's a condition that emerges out of a whole series of factors. So that it might come from emotional stress, it might come from vaccination stress, it might come from poor diet, it might come from chronic miasmatic factors. So all of these need to be identified, and that does take a little bit of extra time. But it's actually quite simple to treat even very complex cases. It just takes a bit of time because you have to navigate the whole panoply of causes, as Stephen pointed out.
Okay.
And, of course, Rudy, you don't want to leave out the ever-popular pathic diseases that are acute.
Yes, of course, absolutely, yeah. Yeah, there are acute pathic diseases that have to be addressed as well.
Based on their symptom picture.
Based on their symptom picture, yeah.
Okay, great. Any other questions?
Yeah, I have a question. You talked earlier about, you know, perhaps people aren't drinking too much, enough. But there are remedies, you know, where that is one of the symptoms. And it seems to me that if you then, you know, if that's the remedy you need, it would change that.
Yes, of course. There's no question that sometimes the fact that they don't drink enough is due to a disease state. And other times, it's just the fact that they don't realize that coffee is not adding any water to their system. It's actually dehydrating them, and that all they require is that having that pointed out. But you also need to distinguish those situations where they're not drinking enough water, because that's their state of mind, that's their illusion. So both of those definitely need to be addressed.
And that reverts back to the assumption made in classical homeopathy that all symptoms belong to homeopathy, where Hahnemann clearly states that is not the case. And if that were the case, he wouldn't have spent all the time he did on outlining the obstacles to cure, which were being brought about by faulty regimen practices. So he definitely did not say, well, if you just look at all faulty regimen practices as exponents of a disease and you give them the right remedy, all will be well. And most especially not today, because we are suborned so often into drinking soft drinks and all sorts of alcoholic beverages and whatnot, which really have a debilitating effect upon the system and our choices that have been made through conditioning. And that is something that needs to be overcome through willpower and cannot be overcome simply by taking a pill that will banish all untoward behavior. Otherwise, there would be no free will. We would all just be automatons waiting for a pill.
Okay, great. Other questions?
Kim?
Yeah, go ahead.
Comment on homeopathy and anthroposophical medicine. In Dr. Andre Olson Julian's Materia Medica of New Remedies, he mentions Dr. 77 under Argentum Metallicum, and he makes an interesting statement. He says that it was the doctor of
tea?
The E. coli.
Okay, do you still want to drink it?
Okay, we're unmuted now, so if people could be respectful. We're trying to hear the whole question. I'm sorry, go ahead, continue.
Dr. Andre Olson Julian's Materia Medica of New Homeopathic Remedies under Argentum Metallicum on page 77, he mentions Rudolf Steiner and says that it was the doctors of the E. coli, E-C-O-L-E, anthroposophique, speaking in French, D.R. Steiner, who brought to light once again the therapeutic action of Argentum Metallicum. And he says on the following page that the doctors and anthroposophic pharmacologists had proceeded in preparing argentum from plants. And if you look in the mental and the head symptoms listed, it's one of the only remedies, there's only two in his book listed for multiple sclerosis, Parkinson's, encephalitis, and other diseases that affect the brain and nervous system. And what was interesting to me was we've used this in my girlfriend's daughter, who was diagnosed with MS 2 years ago at the age of 16, and the doctors are telling us from the MRIs that the brain lesions are shrinking. And it's not just due to Argentum Metallicum, it's due to diet, Chinese herbs, Nature Muriaticum, which is her true constitutional, but it validates the integration of the information gleaned from Dr. Steiner that Dr. Julian incorporated into his homeopathic practice, and it's just astounding what you're able to do with that knowledge. I'm wondering, is there any other information from Dr. Julian that's incorporated into the Helcon's system?
Okay. Did you guys get the question?
Yes.
If I understand the question in terms of Dr. Julian's Materia Medica, I mean, certainly the information that's in there definitely is used. He was one of the first to take a look at the use of various izodes, nozodes, and other remedies, which clearly respond to diseases that and traumas that people have quite frequently today, you know, antibiotics and the various vaccinations, etc. As far as the remedy like Argent Nitricum is concerned, there are clearly there's more scope for research here in terms of some of the anthroposophical preparations as to how they can better be used within the Heilkund system. We've only kind of scratched the surface on that, and they're used at a different level. of the being. I think Stephen could comment on that a little bit more, but they're made very differently. They may be dynamized and potentized at one level, but their whole preparation is much more complex and much more natural pole oriented. So there's a lot of work that still remains to be done there.
Yes, I can only add to what the questioner was saying. By my own examples, I've known several people whose lives were saved because of anthroposophic medicine. And I would like to just respond one more time by saying that when you look at a condition, this is something that we are trained as homeopaths not to do, is to look at conditions, but to go for the disease. But anthroposophic medicine can go head-on to a condition and see it as the result of an imbalance that is going on between the members that we mentioned before, and to give supportive remedies that actually change that balance and bring it into a kind of harmony. Now, if there's a real disease, which is the background, as Hahnemann would describe disease, a background to that disequilibrium, then yes, you're going to need to apply the law of similars and to go at it directly to the disease and not to the condition. So it's just a matter of what you're dealing with and knowing how to reconnoiter the bioterrain. And that's part of the art of this remedial art that we're using, is being able to systematically eliminate the problems that would come from the imbalances created in our lives by so many factors, so that we can finally get at the image, the pure image of the disease. And without doing that, you have to say that you don't have a qualified patient to practice medicine on.
Yeah, you get a lot of duds, and you don't hit the mark very often.
No. So you'd have a huge refraction index when you're trying to look for a disease, and you've got all of these other symptoms swimming around in the same pool, and you just simply can't make out what the image might be. And so in some cases you may be able to, in other cases you will just be lost in the welter. So there has to be a systematic approach, and anthroposophic medicine supplies a tremendous orientation for being able to assess the bioterrain in many different respects. And I wish we could go into more detail on it here, but we just don't have the time.
Well, maybe we'll do another one of these calls and further delve into this whole issue, because I think it's quite interesting, and I'm hoping people appreciate the value of this discussion. But let me unmute it and go for the next question. Hold on.
No.
Other questions?
Hello?
Yeah, we have time for one more question.
Hi, I'm wondering if someone would be able to elaborate on the different bodies.
Okay, did you guys hear that one?
Yep, I did. And elaborate might not be the right word here in 5 minutes, but this is something, as I said before, that Hahnemann himself was really onto, if you read his language correctly, and I took great pains when I did the translation to bring these things out. But it's really when we get to Steiner that we have the most elaborate paradigm for understanding what makes a man, a human being, in terms of their bodily members and as far as their spirit and their soul members. And without that, there would be all sorts of conditions which is just totally unrecognizable or unascertainable. And so anthroposophy supplies this sort of vast scope to the imagination to be able to see just what depth a particular issue will have. And so the etheric body, the astral body, the etheric body has to do with the life functions. It's sort of what a plant has. We share the etheric body in common with a plant. The mineral body we share, obviously, in common with the mineral world around us. But the animal, what makes an animal different than a plant is this astral body. And that has to do with this realm of feelings and various fluctuations as far as psychic elements are concerned. And above that, we have something distinctively human, which Rudolf Steiner called the organization of the I, which is too often rather falsely translated as the ego organization, although technically correct, it's kind of misleading because the ego is part of the problem. But what we have is, well, I could call it the mental organization, although that's not a very good term for it either. And that is where we run into all sorts of problems with beliefs versus knowledge, and what Steiner was advocating, and part of the goal of health was to overcome belief systems and be able to to regenerate our internal organs of knowledge to the point of being able to know and to expand in our knowledge and never having to be based on beliefs, which are always divisive and cause problems further down through the trickle-down effect. So the elaboration on the members is something that you can find in Steiner. It's hugely elaborated in Steiner, and I would only recommend that someone who wanted to know more about this should go directly to Steiner's writings of esoteric science, for example, and get a full explanation.
All right. Well, you know, I'm sure that people could continue asking questions for hours because there's so much rich material here, but we are at the end of our time, so I'm going to unmute and let everyone thank you personally. This call was recorded, and hopefully this time we're not going to have any problems getting it posted up. So for those of you who would like to hear it again, there's a lot of information that you may be new to and not familiar with, and terminology you've never heard before, so you will have an opportunity to hear this call again. And please also tell your fellow classmates and colleagues about these calls and that they are being posted up on our website so that other people who didn't have an opportunity to be live on this call will have an opportunity to listen to Rudy and Stephen at a later time. So before I unmute, I want to personally thank both of you for all three of the calls. I think that they went very well, and hopefully we can have you back for some more calls in the future. Go ahead, let me go ahead and unmute it. Does anyone want to just say thank you?
Hey, thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye, Stephen.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right, take care, everybody.
Thank you.
Jim.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Good night.
Bye-bye.
Hello?